Senate Bill 898. You want to do a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 898 requires the State Board of Chiropractic Examiners to confine performance or conduct investigation to the scope of the specific complaint that the board receives. It also requires that a biased member of a peer review committee resign and be replaced by an unbiased member. It sets time limits on peer review committee evaluation.
Would you, Senator George, would you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much. And thank you for having this hearing today. For the record, my name is State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. I'm sorry about my voice. I'm back into it again. Back in 2001, the legislature passed and was signed by the governor, Senate Bill 288. And basically what that did was it directed the chiropractic board to conduct an investigation pertaining to the complaint. That is ORS 684.150.2A. And what we experienced this year, I personally sat in and witnessed a hearing in which the attorney continued to press the fact that the complaint against the chiropractor was for the issue of payment of bill and nothing else. But the board had decided to go, as we described it, a fishing expedition, a witch hunt beyond that. We also witnessed a couple of other things, complaints by the attorney representing the accused chiropractor, that they needed to honor the days that were required for the appropriate time for the hearing. At this time, Mr. Chairman, if we could, we have a person who has a very limited time. He's in Florida right now, and he was a victim of the process that we have here in Oregon, and I would like, if we can get him on the air, to have him tell the story, because I believe when you hear the story, you'll understand why we need to limit the authority to investigate. Since we're still... Oh, okay, go ahead. You're right. Chairman, would you like...
Hello.
Oh.
Hi, this is the Health and Human Service Committee. We're looking for Dr. Holden.
Yes, speaking.
Dr. Holden, this is Chairman Senator Bill Morissette of the Health and Human Services Committee, and you are on the phone to testify on our Senate Bill 898. And if you would introduce yourself first, please, before you testify.
Jay Holder. I'm primarily a chiropractor. I have other degrees as well. I live and practice chiropractic for 30 years in chiropractic practice for 30 years here in the state of Florida. I hold other state chiropractic licenses as well and other licenses for other things that I do.
Okay. Would you like to go ahead and start your testimony, please?
All right. I would like to first point out that I have never operated a business in the state of Oregon. I've never had an address there. I've never had a license to practice anything in the state of Oregon. I do not have any agenda with the state of Oregon from that perspective. I'll try and make this as brief as I can because it's a process of 9 years of experience with the Oregon Board. Originally what had happened, as I do a lot of lectures for the profession has been gracious enough to make me Chiropractor of the Year, and I've received other what I think are prestigious awards from the profession, wound up being invited to speak for the Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic, a membership chiropractic organization in the state of Oregon. This was around May of 98, and while getting ready in the coffee shop of the hotel where the event was being held, I was approached by Dr. Dallas and Dr. Lester Lamb, the Western States Chiropractic College. They asked if they could join me for coffee. I said, certainly. Of course, they had introduced themselves. I had not met them before. To the quick as they certainly did. They wanted to advise me that I should not be speaking for this organization, that this is not an organization that presents chiropractic the way it should be presented, and other reasons of that sort, and that they would appreciate it if I would just walk away. Well, I've been invited. I'm here. I just can't walk away. That's not very professional. This is a chiropractic association, and the state is it. And I was, told yes. But the organization, the state of Oregon, that we should be supporting is as you referred to, the COA, if I have it right, or CAO. I advise that, I'm certainly, I don't have the intention to just walk out on these people. So I was told, well, I really think that would be a big mistake because there's going to be lots of trouble for you if you don't. They started to get up and walk, and they kept talking to me. I walked with them out to the front of the hotel. At which time Dr. Lamb showed me some papers which seemed to be a CV, a curriculum vitae of my achievement, and asked if I had recognized it, and I said no, it certainly wasn't produced by me, and then smiled and just left. What occurred shortly thereafter, of course, was being sanctioned by the Oregon Board, that my programs wouldn't be recognized, that I'm in violation of various statutes and facing criminal misdemeanor charges for having attained an MD degree and a PhD degree that they decided on their own without due process were fraudulent, based on a packet that they had received about an inch thick of newspaper articles and some Xerox copies of degrees that I didn't recognize that were supposedly my own, that later on I did get to see is what Dr. Lamb had mailed to the OBC, the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners, shortly after the meeting in the coffee room at the hotel, with pretty much in the form of a complaint, and that my MD and PhD degree should be investigated, and here's the proof that they should look at. And the board primarily just looked at competitors' newspaper articles in the field of chiropractic and seminars and speaking and so forth, and it amounted to a great deal of what appeared to be serious allegations, but nothing there was more substantial than newspaper articles and actually contrived documents of degrees that I do not have and from places that I've never heard of before. Realized that, I must be, facing a problem here. I retained an attorney, Mr. David Force, in Oregon. At the board meeting, at the regular chiropractic board meeting of OBCE, I appeared with my attorney to share my side of the story, and it was not a scheduled hearing for me, nor was it a trial. However, they decided to turn it into one, and then they officially found me in violation of a whole bunch of things, including fraudulent credentials. Of course, the plot thickens. The close friends of Dr. Dave McTeague, the director of the OBCE, the chiropractic board, is receiving letters back and forth between Dave McTeague and Don Harrison, a competitor who had written some of those newspaper articles that needed a story on the front page of his competing newspaper, although I don't have a newspaper. His newspaper is primarily an advertising journal with most of his wares, so that people would be attracted to his seminars and programs. And on the front page appeared an article that the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners has found my MD and PhD degrees fraudulent, and my awards as well, and, you know, and as much of a damaging attack to make me a fraud as possible. And, of course, I'm saying to myself all the time, if there was a question about my credentials as a medical doctor, why would that be the purview of the chiropractic board? Oregon has a medical board, but I soon found out that Lester Lamb does not have control of the Oregon medical board. He has very good control of the OBCE, and specifically Dave McKee. As this process continued, lots of legal expenses, and of course that had to stand up to protect my name. It's the only thing I have. And in addition to that,
Doctor, the subject of the bill is a complaint, whether or not a specific complaint should be looked at, or whether or not they should look at the bigger picture. That's what we're here to discuss.
Let me use a different vernacular, because like I said, it's a 9-year history. Essentially what we have, in my opinion, and I've heard for quite some time, of course, a lot of information from the state of Oregon on the activities of the board, and specifically Mr. McTeague, that they go on witch hunts and spend lots and lots of taxpayers' dollars to do that, way beyond what the issue was in the first place. In other words, the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners would receive a request to investigate something. If it's their purview, they should, or they should refer to the proper board. This was not just an investigation. There was no investigation. Just used their board and their position to attack my good name because I refused to walk away from a speaking engagement for the Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic. This process continued, and even through two contempt orders where the Oregon Board and Dave McTeague were found in contempt twice in this process. And here's the language of the sentence from the June 2002 letter from the Oregon Circuit Court judge, his name is Alvin Norblad, Judge Norblad. To quote, McTeague knowingly and intentionally on standard matters of confidentiality violated the court's orders. And this contempt, by the way, was one of two. He just kept doing it. He just kept on disseminating information that wasn't true to attack my credentials, but he used the investigation and complaint process of the board to do it. The only issue was that Dr. Lamb wanted to make it clear to me that I should have walked away. This cost the taxpayers 9 years of litigation. I don't know how much the board spent, but I do know that in the end they had to shell out $12,500 that's really a shame. But I felt it necessary to not only protect my good name, but the process of what was happening and continues to happen to this day in Oregon through a witch hunt mentality going beyond the scope of due process and process for investigating board complaints of chiropractors on chiropractic matters is a personal vendetta by the board in most cases. And this is a lot of money to have been lost and a lot of time to have been lost. And I support the profession wherever I go. And I often speak, pro bono. I do what I can to give back to the profession what I can. And that was the other reason that I entered into a long process of litigation to resolve this matter. There are letters that I have that are available to you from that competitor newspaper person to Dave McTeague. Here's the story. Please check it out. Dave McTeague writes back on top of it, this is correct, I approve it, signs his name and puts OVCE underneath his name. Now, representing his position at OVCE helps to write part of this article, and of course, the headline and the title of the article that he signed off on is Oregon Board Finds Holders MBA and PhD Degrees Fraudulent. Of course, they never did. They tried to, but of course, in the end, they had to take back what they did. This process, to me, in my opinion, is clearly what would be tantamount to racketeering if we just follow this linear path backwards. We have a three-way conspiracy with criminal intent to go after people, witch hunt people, for personal agendas, primarily of close friends of the board. The board is primarily, in my opinion, and other people's opinion, 100% under the control of Western States Chiropractic College, and the other end of the triangle is the CAO.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have a lot of testimony here yet, and I think you got your message across.
I also have available for you Dr. Harrison's deposition, where in his federal court case action against him in this matter, because let's say court, there were separate matters involving him and Mr. McTeague, as this continued, the voluntary settlement includes that he will bear his deposition, which is sealed except for the purpose of being presented in matters against the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners and or Mr. McTeague, and he himself has agreed to testify. We also have Mr. McTeague's and Kelly Bird's depositions available. It's a process in that the board's primary responsibility is supposed to be to protect the public. And, of course, this gives them free rein to do what they want to their licensees. In my case,
We're going to have to move on, Dr. Hogan. I appreciate very much your comments, and thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue. Thank you. If you look at on page 4, section 3, we address the second issue that we witnessed. And I say we, accompanying me to this hearing, this peer review hearing, was a representative from Donna Nelson's office, a young man studying law, and I appreciated him being there. And what came out of that was he and I were able to witness what was without question extreme prejudice by at least two members of that. The attorney protested, as did my chiropractor, who was involved in this issue, the one who was accused. They protested the fact that there was extreme prejudice, within two members of that group. By the time we finished the end of the hearing, we were absolutely convinced that the attorney and the accused were in fact right. I confronted one of the individuals following this, and I said, how could you sit through this when, in fact, you express such great contempt and disrespect for the people who were accused? And he said he didn't have any problem doing that, and that's why Section 3 came in. Then going down to line 29 on through the rest of the new language, we wanted to establish very clearly in law that the peer review committee would be subject to the same timetables that were expected of the main Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Now, I do need to tell you that when you look at, and you go back and look at the language in Senate Bill 288 from the 01 session, we made it very clear what we intended. And the contempt of the director and the contempt of the board to just disregard the action of the legislature, I find overwhelming. So what we did following that meeting, I, within hours, was in contact with legislative counsel. I walked through them what I had witnessed and said, we need a draft clarification so that this board cannot deal with any issue other than in this accusation of a billing irregularity. The interesting thing, Mr. Chairman, with this hearing, it confirmed everything I had heard about this board. The only difference was I was personally witnessing it. And that was very startling, very shocking for me to have to sit there and witness what probably every chiropractor who's ever been accused, the process they go through. And it was totally orchestrated. They ignored the comments and protest of the attorney and the accused. The evidence that was presented was overwhelming. We're talking about documentation that was presented, and I can't go into detail with you, but the information was overwhelming. The findings were that, in fact, the person was guilty. There was no guilt here. This is one of those areas in which we say there is no justice in certain parts of state government. This area, to me, has opened up the can that shows what others have experienced. We have others that would like to testify relative to what they have experienced, identical to what I witnessed, and identical to what Dr. Holden experienced. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Berger.
Thank you. Senator George, what would be possibly the motive behind the witch hunt?
It's very simple. There are two views of chiropractic care in Oregon. In fact, we're going to hear one of the bills later. The one view is the chiropractor is a person that uses the standard traditional methods of chiropractic care. The other group intends to bring in pain-killing drugs. Also, it's a turf battle between those who have gone through a certain university, certain college, and those who come from other experience, other educational backgrounds. And so it appears to me that based on everything that I have been able to find out investigating, that it evolves around two things: managed care and a desire of a certain unit to mandate a certain kind of care, than the idea of the pharmaceuticals that would be involved. And anyone who stands up against this is subject to this kind of discipline. Now, the individual that I'm talking about, my chiropractor, asked me about a year and a half ago. He said, I'm tired of this. I'm going to leave the board. I said, do you dare leave the board? Do you dare? And he said, what do you mean? I said, I think they'll go after you. It was only a matter of months before they came up with this claim and proceeded, which, by the way, this case is still open today. And it's still under the board's disciplinary action.
Okay. Dave, would you like to comment now, or do you want to wait for a while?
Mr. Chair, if you want to call us up now.
Well, okay, let's go through a few more, and then we're going to balance.
Okay.
Representative Nelson, would you come up, please?
Chair Morissette and distinguished members of this committee, I thank you for giving me this opportunity today to discuss Senate Bill 898. And first of all, I want to just say that I'm sad I have to come to you today regarding this matter. This should never happen. This important bill is necessary to protect practicing doctors of chiropractic from undue hardship when the State Board of Chiropractic Examiners, the very individuals who are supposed to be looking after the consumer, perform their investigations. It's vital to the health and safety of Oregonians that anyone providing medical services be properly licensed and fit to practice. As such, professional boards need the ability to investigate consumer complaints. However, there is a fine line between a necessary and proper investigation and an administrative nightmare. And I would just like you to know that firsthand I understand exactly this nightmare that Senator George just spoke to. The current practices of the State Board of Chiropractic Examiners, while surely well-intentioned, I would hope, have created such a hardship for practicing doctors that they frustrate the very purpose for which the board was formed, consumer protection. When the investigative process is drawn out for long periods of time, digging into every component of a doctor's practice, the real victims are the patients, who end up paying more for while receiving less health care. Boards exist and function as they're defined by this legislature. It's therefore proper for the legislature, by statute, to provide necessary guidance and directions to the board. Senate Bill 898 does exactly that. This bill establishes clear guidelines for the State Board of Chiropractic Examiners to follow while conducting investigations. It requires investigations to be completed within a 120-day time frame, and most importantly, prohibits investigations beyond the scope of the complaint. It also ensures neutrality during the investigative process. These new guidelines will ensure that qualified doctors of chiropractic can continue to provide services for their patients while maintaining the ability of the board to investigate legitimate consumer complaints. This will result in an appropriate level of consumer protection while at the same time protecting patients from rising costs for quality health care and access to quality health care. I urge you, Chair Morissette and members of this committee, to support this bill. I'm not sure, because in my four terms of being here, I don't know what the proper way is to bring an issue like this to light. I have another very similar issue about another board in the legislature that will probably come to you also. It should never get here, but we do not have in place a process when something like this happens that is grossly wrong and unfair to a practicing physician. I appreciate your support, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. David, did you... Mr. McKee. Oh, Gary, excuse me. Gary, would you stay for just a minute?
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Sure, we'd be happy to.
I do have a question. What is this specific complaint? Now, let me expand on that. I understand that there is a complaint concerning billing, say. What if there have been other complaints concerning billing? Are they excluded from the specific complaint? I'm not talking trying to dig things up. I'm talking what's obvious on the record. If there is a record that says, you know, there are two complaints over a certain issue and here's a third complaint, now are you saying they can't consider the first two?
The drafter of the bill, we considered that issue, and his opinion was that it was not. It's just that you couldn't take a billing question and look at improper handling of a patient or, let's say, for example, an accusation of improper conduct, that it had to be relative to the subject, which was, in fact, a billing dispute.
Okay.
By the way, a billing dispute that was resolved, and the board was aware of that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So and I imagine that there are records of complaints that are on file, and if a new complaint comes in, and it's only, and it is billing, does that mean that they can't look at the record of complaints on other things? They don't have to go fishing for them. They're simply on, already on file. So if there's an accumulation of various complaints on the piece of paper that you're looking at, can you not, are they excluded under this specificity clause?
Mr. Chairman, do you see specific language that would exclude that? Because if you look at the language before and after the new inserts, I think it makes it clear that they can, I mean, obviously, if we had a person who's saying, I was injured in the practice, or the person made sexual advances to me, or something like that, obviously those kind of complaints are so broad that you should be able to go just about anywhere.
Okay.
The issue here was, is they took a very simple complaint, and it was actually an act of vendetta by the person who, in fact, filed the complaint.
Okay.
He was in the process of negotiating a settlement.
Okay. I was just wanted to be sure that the word specific did not preclude looking at things that are already on file and so on.
I really think that it would, and we could probably get the drafter down here. I believe what this would do would be, depending on the kind of complaint, as I said, if it was a poor practice or a sexual advancement or something like that, I think that would open the door for quite a bit of an investigation.
Okay. Good. Okay. Thank you. Sure. Senator Cruz.
Thank you. Senator George, page 4, section 3, sub 1, the new language you make reference to. To ORS Chapter 183 as far as the matter, to resolve the matter of resignation. I've been trying to quick through this and trying to find out what part of 183 deals with that. Do you know off the top of your head?
No, I do not. And okay. I would point out that the question we raised, or that was raised that day in the hearing, was directed to the Attorney General's staff that was there. And apparently they believed there was a process in place. It's just they didn't believe that the prejudice had arisen to that level. They would ask them to step down.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the reason I asked that, and I'd like some clarification at some point on that, is because this seems to be somewhat subjective. If there is clear defined process in here, the subjectivity may be better defined. I just haven't found it yet. So,
okay. We would be happy to look at additional amendments if we need to clarify that.
Thank you very
Thanks.
Much. There are several other people who wish to testify in support of the bill, but let's kind of vary a little bit. And Mr. McKeag, if you want to come up with your group, and then we'll go back and hear other testimony.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Should we do that first? Okay, there. If you could just sit there for a few minutes. Apparently, there are several other phone calls that people are waiting to. So we'll do that very briefly. Thank you for your patience. Hello?
It was an answering machine.
Oh, okay, okay. Answering machine. Would you introduce yourself, please? And
My name is Minga Guerrero, and I'm president of the board.
Dave McTeague, Executive Director, Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Our office is here in Salem. You've heard some testimony today on so far on Senate Bill 898. So far this session, we've had a great deal of harmony among the chiropractic associations and the board, and so I'm sorry that today kind of breaks what so far has been a very harmonious session for the chiropractic profession. But the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, of course, is very opposed to Senate Bill 898 and believes it would seriously harm the board's public protection mission. The language that says seeks to limit the OBC to investigating the specific complaint. You were talking a little bit ago about sexual misconduct complaints, and boy, if there's ever the kind of case where public harm is threatened to patients, and I mean real harm, it's the area of sexual boundaries and sexual misconduct. And I will say that in only a very small percentage of healthcare professionals engage in this kind of behavior, but when they do, it has devastating, potentially devastating conflicts. We investigated one case that I'm going to talk about for a period of 2 to 3 years. It took a long time for this to kind of all come together, and it came from initially just one complainant. And as the investigation proceeded, the investigator would say, well, do you know of anybody else this has happened to? Well, they say, well, I've heard so-and-so had an experience, and so-and-so had an experience. Then he would talk to those people, and they find out another person had an experience or something to the effect like, well, everybody knows this is going on. Well, not everybody does know what is going on. And slowly we untangled a case and came up with 11 female patients who'd been victimized by this one doctor over a 13 or 14 year old period. The doctor had a previous disciplinary sanction for boundaries violation. So when I talked to the investigator and said, well, when you're investigating a specific complaint from the original complainant and you find out this other information, we're expanding the investigation on our own motion. Well, yeah, because that's what we have to do to protect the public. And this case with the Terry Womack case, I have a 37-page order here and all its unfortunate detail, and it's on our webpage if anybody wants to read it or if any member of this committee wants to take a look at the work that we did on that case. That was truly one that we spent an enormous amount of time and on, and it really did strain my patience. Talk about timelines. You know, I kept saying to the investigator, can't we close this case down? We got a performance measure we're trying to meet. No, we got to follow up on this other lead. We have to follow up on this other lead. Well, the investigator was right. You know, whatever time it took was the time we had to take to investigate that and get it all right. We did go to contested case hearing, and last June we spent the entire week in Pendleton in a contested case hearing. We put on our case, his attorney put on their case, and the administrative law judge rendered an opinion which the board accepted. And it was a tough decision to take away a doctor's license, but it was the right decision in this case. So when we have language that says we can't expand the investigation on its own motion, you know, that just would put the total crimp in our ability to investigate the most serious threats to public safety. And let me go on to talk about another case that may be a little more pertinent to peer review. We had a peer review case not that long ago. The complaint was brought by a former patient of the doctor alleging billing for services and supplies not provided. This is not the case that Senator George was speaking to, and saying that, you know, she got massage for 5 to 7 minutes, but the billing said she got them for 15 minutes, and she had issues with that. And she was billed for exercise tubing, but was never provided the exercise tubing. So that raised some issues. Of course, the patient filed the complaint. The patient doesn't have the expertise of a chiropractic physician or even an insurance claims representative know what to file, what to complain about exactly, but the patient thought there were issues. Well, the peer review committee did a thorough examination of the entire patient file and billing records because that's what's necessary to review this kind of complaint. They found the doctor did a number of things perfectly okay, but the peer review committee determined that the complaint, that the patient, the doctor's record keeping did not meet minimum standards of chiropractic. It was too confusing and too convoluted for any other doctor to pick up and continue the care of that patient should that be necessary. That's a very important finding because everything hinges on your ability to be able to interpret what the doctor's care has been and what they are prescribing and what they're diagnosing and all of that. And also the peer review committee found that there were patient records that were altered and that was chart note documentation was rewritten on numerous occasions without corresponding explanation on the altered record. And handwriting differed on different sets of patient chart notes. Now, this is within the chiropractic, you know, clinical world. This is serious to be altering patient records and chart notes with no explanation. Was that directly related to the patient's complaint, specific complaint? Well, not exactly, no. But it was relevant to this doctor and the issues that were pertinent to the complaint and all of that. So that's another example of how this language would be unduly limiting. The issue of the peer review timelines. Nobody wants to see peer review investigations be completed more timely than I do. But it's more challenging than that. First of all, we have to try and make sure the peer review committee has all the information. And what if the respondent licensee is slow to give it up, slow to provide it, or doesn't want to provide it? Well, that takes time. What if the respondent licensee doesn't want to submit to a hearing, is trying to avoid it at all possible, has scheduling conflicts, is going on vacation? That takes time to resolve. Or has an attorney who's not available. That's one of the most common things we run into, attorney schedules. And then a peer review committee is a committee of seven doctors. Well, they're busy too. We would love to have all our peer review committees review the complaint, interview the doctor, have the report written within 120 or 150 days, and many times we do meet that. I'd be happy to set that up as some kind of a performance standard, but to say at the end of that 150 days, you're done, you're over, you can't continue to investigate, doesn't protect the public either. The problem with the specific language on peer review recusal, well, number one, we already have administrative rules on that subject. If a person has a close personal or professional relationship with the person under review, they should recuse, and oftentimes we do have persons recuse. The idea of inserting another contested case process into this whole issue of peer review recusal would give a respondent a licensee who wants to be less than cooperative or is in a fighting mood a way to delay the proceeding and delay the process. We're trying to speed the process up and bring these to a speedy conclusion. And typically, this hasn't been an issue. In the one case, there was some dispute over this. If there is a dispute over a recusal of a peer review member, that becomes an issue at contested case hearing. If a board takes the peer review committee's report and on the basis of that drafts a notice of proposed disciplinary action, which gives the respondent licensee their hearing contested case rights, all those issues go in front of an administrative law judge. The administrative law judge were then to rule that this person should have recused and therefore the peer review committee report should be given less weight. Well, the administrative law judge could do that. In this one isolated case that seems to be at issue today, the board did not, in the end, undertake a disciplinary action. They took an alternative. They went an alternative route. They issued a non-disciplinary, strongly worded letter of concern, not the same thing as a disciplinary action. The case was characterized as being open, the case at issue is now a closed case as far as the board is concerned. Issue closed. So that's our concern with timelines. We try very hard to meet timelines. We're trying to meet all the other timelines. We have two performance measures for this board about meeting timelines, and we struggle with those. And we don't always meet those as much as we'd like, but we're surely trialing, and the legislature is helping us this session by giving us some additional dollars to work in that area. So in summary, The board has real concerns with Senate Bill 898, and we would ask you to not pass this out.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator Bridger.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Are you always complaint-driven?
Do you mean... Here's one thing that frequently happens. We're doing lots of background checks now, criminal background checks, and every once in a while an issue comes up. So we open an executive session case file, and so I guess we would consider that an internally generated complaint. So for we are complaint driven. Yes,
I mean by complaint driven, sir. I mean, are you from an outside complaint driven? I go to the chiropractor, so then I come to the board and I'm a complaint. So that
yes.
drives you to open the door to look into my complaint.
Correct.
I'm not talking about an internal type of you're deciding to do a background check. But are you complaint driven
yes,
on your
we
investigations?
Yes, we very much. We very
follow
much
up,
are.
Yeah. How many licenses have you revoked in the past 5 years?
Senator Verger, we have revoked or surrendered since 2001 four licenses, and it's possible one or two of those might have been chiropractic assistants.
Since 2001?
Correct.
Would you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Dr. Minga Guerrero. I'm a chiropractor and president of the board.
So you have revoked four licenses in the past 5 years. All right. One more, Mr. Chairman. How many investigations have you performed in that period of time?
In the last 5 years?
Right.
Well, I'm passing out a set of complaint statistics to you right now, which also includes a summary of board actions in the last 2 years, and you can see the numbers at the bottom in total complaints. I have these numbers are by total complaints received. So we do some kind of an investigation on all the complaints.
Right.
You know, some of them are very simple. Some of them are we look at it, we analyze it, we write to the doctor, get a written response, make sure everything's in order, and send it to the board. Others take more in-depth investigations. Probably 20% of the complaints take some real in-depth investigation. Sometimes, like the one I just described to you, can take the majority of the investigators' time for, you know, months on end. That's become a little bit of a problem for us, but that's what happens.
Would you like to?
Yes. I would like to say that I am opposed to this Senate bill because primarily I feel that the public does not realize sometimes when they're making a complaint the whole issue surrounding a complaint. And I know Dave has given a couple examples, but I've been on the board now 3.5 years, and some of the times the patient may complain that a doctor is leaving them on hot packs too long. And then we find out, well, the reason for that is the doctor is abusing drugs. And, you know, it is not part of the patient's complaint. The patient verbally relays the information, oh, well, the doctor is asking to borrow my prescription medications. But I don't want to really file a complaint about that. I just don't want them leaving me on hot packs too long. They don't realize which problem is causing which and which is the graver of public concern that we look at professionally. And certainly we don't want people scalding on hot packs, but we don't want doctors under the influence of drugs when they should not be. The other thing that I want to point out to you is there is a duty to report. And oftentimes when we're investigating a problem, if we see things such as the chart note problems that were may seem like a minor point, but it could hinge on a person losing all their financial compensation in a motor vehicle accident or an injury case. The chart notes are so bad that the patient will never reclaim anything for their injuries. We find this as doctors to be a big problem in the profession, and we don't want to see it happen. So the patient may not have complained, oh, my doctor's chart notes are terrible. They might make a complaint that is different, but we see that the chart notes are so heavily related to the problem that we bring it in. And I also want to say, as board president, I do feel a strong sense of compassion, and it is a very difficult thing sitting on a state board, and I think that this WOMAC case tested us to the very end. It was horrible to see the effect on the community, the effect on the doctor's family. It's a really difficult thing for us sitting on a board to have to look at these issues, but we've taken a pledge and we take it very seriously, and I think we've balanced very well compassion with the justice that we are looking at.
You may not know the answer to this, but I'm kind of curious about what procedure other boards and commissions similar to yours uses, the Board of Medical Examiners, the Board of Nursing, and so on and so forth. I guess that would tell me whether or not your procedures are in keeping with the standard procedures that should
right.
be used, or whether or not you're deviating and so on. Is there any... And I don't know of any oversight other than the legislature to determine whether or not these procedures are valid. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when my counterpart, Gary Schnabel, was in here from the pharmacy board about a month ago, he was asked this question about what would he do if they were looking at a pharmacy and they saw some other violations. And he made it clear that the pharmacy board had full scope to review whatever potential violations they encountered in any review that they did. And we don't actually go into clinics in that, you know, to do inspections. That's not part of our program. We believe our purview for investigations is very similar to other boards. Other boards have peer review committees. The Board of Medical Examiners, they have a kind of a complaint review committee, because which is kind of a screening committee, really, because we get 90 complaints a year. They get like 11 or 12 or 1300 or something like that. So they're trying to weed them out so the board reviews a smaller subset that have been kind of vetted and reviewed ahead of time.
Okay.
So
I do have a bill that is hopefully going to be heard that would require all boards and commissions that receive complaints to do. This is kind of a super performance measure that every year they will submit a list to the legislature of all of the complaints heard during that year, the disposition of the complaint, that if it has been settled, the disposition of the complaint if it's an ongoing complaint, that would give us all, well, it would be a reporting system that many people are probably doing, and you may be doing that, but I mean, we as a legislature are the oversight, and we need to get a handle on the types of complaints. Okay. Now, I am including the contractors board as well. I mean, any board or commission, and there are a lot of boards and commissions, but every once in a while there are serious complaints or concerns that complaints are not being heard in a timely manner, that complaints are way off target, and so on and so forth. So I'm still interested in what the commonality is among all of these boards, if there's a standard procedure that boards are using.
I know the state bar does that. They definitely look to areas outside of the original named complaints. I'm working with them right now on a case that I personally filed, and I've verbally communicated, and they are looking at other things besides what exactly was in the complaint that I filed. So I just figured this was
okay.
Standard.
So the state bar, in investigating your specific complaint, is looking at other types of complaints.
Against the same
person. Same individual.
Yes. And they let me know about this. And it has to do with multiple complaints that came in simultaneous that were interrelated that I don't have knowledge in the law to know what to say.
Okay, and maybe one of the distinctions, and when I asked Senator George this question about specificity, if there are a number of complaints on file that you simply have to open the file and look at them, then that's one thing. If you do an extended investigation looking for other complaints, I think that's kind of what he is getting at. Now, I don't know if you do that. Do you look at other types of complaints or just the pattern that is being... One thing leads to another is what you said.
I think that's primarily it, Senator, that when our peer review committee looks at a billing complaint, they want to look at all the billings to see what was done before, what was done later, what were the patterns, does it all make sense, was there justification for the billings. So they take a big look at all the billing issues. They don't just focus it on billing on this date or that date or this, you know, this particular week. They look at all the billing issues and then
on that one patient.
On that one patient. Right. Right.
On that one patient.
Right. We don't go looking at other patients.
Okay. No.
You don't look at.
No. Some years ago we did, and we took a lot of heat for that, and we kind of rolled back and said, well, you know, we understand the pros and cons. The pro is we're just looking at that one, and we're not going beyond that. The con is we don't know if it's an isolated incidence of just poor work on one patient, and we don't know if it extends to others. The board said, fine, if we'll just look at the one patient and render an opinion on just that one circumstance, if that's what people want us to do. So. Okay.
Senator Bridge.
Thank you. when you get a complaint, would you explain to me the process that you go through?
Sure. Generally, the complaint comes in, and the staff compiles the information for the board members. It might take some investigative work before it's even presented to the board. That it could be possible if they have to request chart notes, things that we have to look at. Once the complaint is compiled, then it's presented to the board. The board then looks at the complaint, and as a body, we decide if we can make a ruling immediately that day, we do it. If we cannot, then maybe we need to send it to peer review so that we'll have more people looking at one thing instead of just our 7-member group. Maybe we want to, for some reason, it could be that it could take hours to comb through a file. It could be that there are multiple billing questions. And so we want peer review to do this because they can sit at length and review all of it. Then they make a report back to us, and they give us a numbered seriousness of a claim. It could be graded 0 to 10, you know, how bad is this problem? And sometimes they'll say there is no problem. And then we get that back, and we make a determination based on peer review.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? In 2005, you had 18 complaints for unprofessional conduct. If that comes into the office, who does what?
we look at the complaint and we categorize it, and we have one staff person who takes a look at it. Usually it goes to the investigator. Sometimes I see them if they're advertising. Some of the complaints I deal with, because our investigator, he's working on cases, and I try not to bog him down with just a lot of the other cases that come in. But I'll look at them. Other staff will look at them. And there's three of us that work on these issues. And if it's the case where we just simply need to write a letter and ask the doctor to respond, then one of us will do that and get that letter out. And then when we get the response back, then we determine what further inquiries may be needed or if we need to do any in-person interviews. If it's a sexual misconduct or boundaries complaint, that goes straight to the investigator. And then he has his own way of investigating, which may involve a lot of investigation before we seek the doctor's response.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One thing that's missing here is that when do you notify the doctor that you have received a complaint about him?
In most cases, we notify them fairly soon. because we want to get the response and get it packaged up and get it done and get it to the board. In some investigations, that's not the best thing. And that's really, you know, kind of a professional decision I leave to the investigator because he's the expert in that area. And in this case, you know, he did some interviews with the complainant and with the corroborating witnesses before he went to see the doctor right off the bat. So on some sensitive cases, he's going to want to do some inquiry before he does that first interview with the doctor. So, but that's kind of an investigative, you know, craft kind of a thing.
Final question.
Yes.
And so when the board actually hears it, you may be hearing it for the first time.
Correct.
And it with all the background work would have been done.
Correct.
And it's brought to you, and you have a file, and you look at the file, and the investigator or the staff person or both sit in on the board and go through the file.
Yes.
At what point do you hear from the doctor?
We don't always hear from the doctor. Some of the cases, like, for instance, advertising, if it's deceptive advertising, some more the minor problems, we might not hear from them at all, other than letters that they send us. Once in a while, doctors want to appear before the board, and then we hear from them. It would be like the next meeting, the very next meeting. I don't recall, since I've been on the board, if we've actually, we had maybe one special session, I think, we had to call. But generally, we meet every 2 months, and so if we see a case, the doctor may request to speak to us, and then they would come before us in 2 months at our next session.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to make one more quick phone call, and then we are probably going to have to move on to another issue. We're trying to do several bills here. And there's another person in the audience who wishes to testify. We will take your testimony, but we want to keep it brief, please.
Oh, that was quick.
What's this person saying?
Good afternoon, David Forrest's office. This is Christy.
Christy, this is Senator Bill Morissette, Chair of the Health and Human Services Committee for Dr. Force.
Okay, one moment.
This is David Force.
Dr. Force, this is Senator Bill Morissette, Chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, and we're hearing testimony on Senate Bill 769. I'm sorry, 898. Are you prepared to give testimony right now?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay, would you...
First Senator. Sorry.
Thank you. Would you identify yourself, please?
Yes, my name is David Force, F-O-R-C-E. I'm an attorney and dean. I practice at 96... East Broadway, Suite 2, Eugene.
Okay, go ahead and testify.
All right. I only learned of the existence of this bill Friday afternoon, and I only got a copy of it today, a little bit ago, so these will be brief remarks. But I want to say that as far as it goes, I think it's just fine. I don't see how anybody could really complain about or oppose what it proposes. From my point of view, as a person who's represented a number of chiropractors over a period of about 20 years now, who have had issues with the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, I would hope that you might consider taking things just a little bit further than this bill goes. My concern, and you've probably heard a lot of testimony like this, is that essentially the board has used its disciplinary authority, or misused, in my view, many times over the past many years as a way to settle political scores within the chiropractic community and by the insurance industry and the medical industry kind of against chiropractic, and I don't think that was the intention of the legislature when it created the board. I would point out a couple of things just really quickly that you might want to look at. ORS 684.100 subsection 1 or section 1 subsection Q allows the board to discipline, including revoking the license of any chiropractor for violation of any rule enacted under the chapter. And then ORS 684.150 subsection 1 allows the board to make, quote, such rules as it deems proper, close quote. So what you have here is a situation in which the board can be and often is the complainant, the prosecutor, the judge, the jury, and the executioner, because it makes the rule that it deems proper that makes something that some chiropractor is doing a violation, and then it goes ahead to prosecute that chiropractor for a violation of that rule it has made. That's an awfully broad delegation, and if you look at other delegations of rulemaking authority in throughout the Oregon Revised Statutes, you'll find it very uncommon for the legislature to give any unelected body the right to make any rules that it deems proper. I think that it might make some sense for the legislature to limit the board's rulemaking authority to matters involving the protection of the public and consumers rather than simply anything it deems proper. That's all I can add at this point. I haven't, as I said, I haven't had an opportunity to give this an awful lot of thought since I didn't know the bill existed until Friday nor did I see it until late this morning. But I do think it's a great idea to impose some limits on peer review, which in my experience sometimes has been useful and sometimes has been, in my view, very much misused. But I also think, frankly, that the legislature should think seriously about imposing some limits on the discretion of the board itself, because I frankly think that's where the problem is. The board and its professional staff have been antagonistic towards a large portion of the chiropractic profession for many years, and it's not, in my view, the role of a regulatory agency acting on behalf of the state to be a forum for acting out these kinds of interprofessional political disputes, and I'm afraid that that's largely what the board does these days. I just think it's an unfortunate development that the legislature should look at. So I thank you for your attention to that.
Mr. Forrest, in just a moment, we have a question for you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Can you hear?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. First of all, I need to know, have you represented a chiropractor's when they have received complaints from the board of chiropractic? Have you?
Yes, I have.
And how many has that been? Five?
I'm trying to remember. I've done it over a long period of time. I think probably a total of less than 10, mm-hmm. although there have been a couple of them who had more than one proceeding.
And has the board been found at fault?
Has the board been found at fault? What do you mean by that?
Well, when you represent a chiropractor, did the chiropractor, your client, prevail, or were you able to settle out of court, or were you able to? What was the final? Is it called a deposition? No, I don't know.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. There were two occasions when I took decisions of the board involving my clients to the Oregon Court of Appeals on appeals from decisions they had made. On one of those occasions, the Court of Appeals reversed them. On the other one, it was the matter was in fact resolved at an appellate settlement conference. But there isn't any way for the board to be found at fault. The board is supposedly an impartial adjudicatory body. My concern is that in my experience, it doesn't seem like that's really what's going on.
Senator,
it's not a party, it's the judge.
Senator Mona Sanderson has a follow-up question.
No, I basically what I wanted to know is when action is taken against the board, I was just wondering if in more cases than not were they found in the wrong.
Well, as far as I know, there aren't any actions taken against the board. I actually represented a chiropractor who from another state who brought a lawsuit against an employee of the board, and he prevailed in that, and my client prevailed in Marion County Circuit Court in that case, in that lawsuit, and that was settled also up at the level of the Court of Appeals Appellate Settlement Conference when the state appealed from it. But it's not an adversarial thing where chiropractors bring complaints against the board. The board brings complaints against chiropractors. So the conduct of the board is not at issue. It's the conduct of the chiropractor against whom some kind of complaint is made.
Well, what I just wanted to know is, did the chiropractors, were they found harmless?
How many cases did you win and how many did you lose?
Well, it doesn't really happen that way, but I think most of the cases I have represented chiropractors in have been settled. The question is, was there really a need to bring those complaints in the first place? Because it costs the chiropractors a lot of money. I try to be reasonable in my fees, but I'm not inexpensive. And when you're up against the state of Oregon, they have, of course, unlimited litigation resources and enjoy spending those unlimited resources. So, it isn't a matter of, I guess I would say that one case in Marion County Circuit Court and that one case in the Court of Appeals, I won. The other cases have all been resolved in some other way.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We have a couple other people to testify. Sir, would you please come up and be brief? We want to do one other bill before we leave here today. And if you would introduce yourself, please.
I certainly will. I've got some handout material as well.
Okay. Pepsi.
My name is Dr. Roger Sotera. I'm a doctor of chiropractic. I'm retired at this point, but I practiced in Portland, Oregon for about 40 years, 30-some years. And I've done about every activity any chiropractor could possibly do in the state of Oregon. Been president of the state association twice, president of the Portland Metro chapter seven times. Been on the editorial for staff for association for probably 30 years. Written more articles than any chiropractor in the history of chiropractic. Received more awards than any chiropractor living in the state of Oregon. I was on the board two terms. Appointed originally in 93 and reappointed in 96. I want to give you a little bit of history of what you need to know about this whole issue. We were given a legislative mandate following 1197, which is the Workers' Comp Reform Bill, to clean up our profession. We started to do that. That's one of the, that's what the real philosophical differences are between the two associations. We have the Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic, which I'm a member of, who wants to do that, have a regular basic fee schedules, and to take care of the problem doctors who are practicing in our state. There are no philosophical differences other than that. The other thing is that our association fought against the introducing drugs into the profession of chiropractic, known as the DCM program. And you have that with you. You have that. I'll go through that with you. The first case I want to talk about is the Dr. Tilden case. Dr. Tilden was accused by another doctor. He was before the board to be sanctioned. And the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, was I was on the board, never followed statutes and rules as they should have. The Tilden case, there was many, many examples. I'm going to give you a few highlights because I know you don't have a lot of time. The Tilden case is one. There were five board members on the board at the time. Three board members were present during the final dispensation of the Tilden case. One of those was a business partner of Dr. Tilden, and I felt that they should have excused himself, but they did not. Instead, they voted on this case. I told them I refused to vote. The vote was, they put me down as voting yes anyway. I said, hey, look, I didn't vote, and I'm not going to vote. They said, what are you going to do about it? Well, I'm complaining. I complained about it then. I'm complaining about it now. Second example, the first example you have is a Dr. Kathleen Galligan, who was appointed to the Board of Examiners. Dr. Kathleen Galligan was a member of Western States Chiropractic College, and we had a rule at that time, which you have on the next page, which says that anybody who is working for the school can't go on the Board of Examiners. They appointed her to the Board of Examiners anyway. She was appointed to the board while a member of the staff at Western States Chiropractic College. We have every new member's passed out an orientation handbook, and the handbook kind of tells you what to do, what you can't do, kind of a guideline thing. Okay, and basically, what I circled a couple things. The first one is be careful what you say and represent yourself, because it could make board policy. The second page, it says, once established, a rule has the force of law, and for all persons or entitled whom the law applies must adhere to it. In other words, we have a law, a rule in force, and you're supposed to adhere to it. The board did not with the Galligan case. I'll make a reference to the other one in a moment. Concerning drugs and chiropractic. This is just a couple. There's just a couple of highlights I gave you under statutory law that talks about the use of pharmaceuticals in our profession. Well, we had a college, a association, and many board members who are very adamant about getting drugs in our profession. And it was for myself and a few others to stop it. Even though we had statutory law, the board members ignored it. They took an oath to uphold all rules and laws. They did not. Sexual misconduct. We talked about sexual misconduct. When we testified about the legislature, about the board wanting to make a 50% fee increase 5 years ago, that is the Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic, we received a lot of opposition. One of the arguments they used, well, we need to put these rules in effect, which would cost probably our profession between $150,000 to $500,000, because we need rules for sexual misconduct. We pointed out to the hearing that we don't need guidelines. We have rules, and here they are for you to look at. There's a whole set of rules about sexual misconduct. So Senator George's issue is already answered. We have all these rules already in place. And if you violate one of those, your rear end is grass. Okay? The sad part about it was, we found out, was the board didn't know they existed. Again, the board's not following statutes and rules. My final point, the flea spitting issue. Dr. Guerrero made a remark on the listserv about flea spitting. And what she's talking about is flea splitting. Remember that little thing I said, we'll come back to it later? Whatever you say, come back to haunt you? Under this guide orientation handbook, that's exactly what we're talking about. This agency is exactly these basic examples I've given you, and believe me, I have a lot more. If you ever have time, I'll be happy to give them to you. This agency does not follow its statutes and rules. It has not for a long time. It witch hunts, it does what it wants to. What we uncovered was the board wanted to do random auditing. They denied they wanted to do random auditing. In other words, walk into a doctor's office and audit for no reason at all. But we had them on tape. So they couldn't deny the fact that they were going to do it. They wanted to do it, but we stopped them from doing it. I had a very frustrating time on the Board of Examiners. There had a lot of accusations were leveled against me when I was on there. But I didn't violate any statutes or rules, nor did I turn my back on any of them. I support this bill. I support what Senator George is doing. Regarding Dr. Siegfried specifically, this complaint that was leveled against him, they dismissed it. Cost him $15,000. A lot of personal stress for nothing. It was simply a witch hunt because Dr. Siegfried opposed the board 5 years ago with me and many others about wanting to increase our fees. There is a rule in there that says you walk in with the blinders on. I forgot where it is now. Not followed. Many doctors out there practice in fear. Believe me, I know all about that. I looked over my shoulder for years figuring they could come in here for any reason at all and find something. Every doctor out there practices in fear. And yet the real criminals, they're not going after. The real issues aren't being resolved. We had to do and introduce bills legislatively to get those accomplished. And we should not have had to do that. That was a lot of money spent by a lot of doctors who we should not have had to do that. Our association, 5 years ago, spent between $80,000 and $100,000 opposing the 50% increase and basically the board going out and doing exactly what they say they're not doing, they're doing. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, just a minute. In terms of oversight of any of the boards that deal with medical practices, okay, let me back up just a bit. There was a complaint. There were some complaints against the Board of Nursing. The Attorney General became involved in that particular case. Of course, that involved criminal activity to some of the people who were neglected. Is there any other oversight other than the legislature over the practices of the boards in terms of their rules and so on, their statutory language that establishes the boards? And there's, but
well, we have nowhere to go. For example, the Kathleen Galligan issue, I testified before her appointment hearing twice, pointing out the law, the rules.
Yeah.
The legislature turned its back on it. Said it was a bad rule, but it was a rule in place. We had a public hearing, of course. There were 14 for it and 211 against it. They still pulled the rule and appointed her. In the case of the DCM program, I tried to collect in evidence to provide to the Attorney General's office. A lot of the evidence I gave to turn in was withheld from the Attorney General's office because they wanted drugs so badly they would have done anything to get it in chiropractic. Trust me, they would have done anything.
So what you're saying is that the legislature is the oversight body.
Where else do we go?
No, okay.
I retired. Okay, I'm lucky financially. I'm a wealthy old mother. Okay. I've worked really hard. I still do that. The reason I'm down here is because they have no hook into me any longer. If I was still in practice, I wouldn't be here. I talked to Dr. Siegfried earlier. He wanted to come here, and I said, George, you're better off not going down there. Because the hook is into him. And he's practicing in fear. If they can go after you for nothing, what this is what this basic complaint was nothing. It was like a crosswalk, a minor traffic violation. What the heck are we doing going after a guy like that for that for? Now, we have a lot of other crime out there that's being committed that they look the other way on. And I'm not going to address that at this particular point. I've spent years trying to resolve that issue with the OBCE, and we had to do it legislatively. But it has to do with the legislature told us before 1197 to clean up your bad apples. Okay? The OBC has not done that. They don't go in that direction. We had to do that legislatively.
Okay. Senator George, you had a question.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you for your testimony, and you're absolutely right. I could have filled this room two or three times over, but they're all afraid. You articulated that. They're
yes.
afraid. Back in 01, when we passed Senate Bill 288, I think you actually worked on that. And if we go down here to Section 2A, it says this, upon receipt of a complaint, the board has the authority to investigate, administer oaths, take affidavits, and so on, pertaining to the complaint. What did you believe that that did? Do you believe that that accomplished what this bill, the 898, is attempting to do?
Right. That's exactly what it's supposed to do. It says work on the complaint. The other thing that came out of all those hearings was the legislature told the board not to continue developing guidelines. They did it anyway. They're going to ignore almost anything they don't want to ignore. Okay, they're still doing the guideline process. Even though they were told and not given money to develop the guideline process, they did it anyway. See, so they're—I don't know—they're going to—they definitely ignored what they were told.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Just one final comment. Since I've been in the legislature since 2001, there's always been this conflict in amongst the chiropractors, and it really is disheartening because I feel that both sides are destroying the profession, and I'm not putting the blame anywhere. And I wish that there would be more work on trying to come together and work together because I feel that chiropractors have a wonderful role in this state, but we are always dealing with the conflict in the profession.
We understand that.
So
we have the difference is not philosophy. The difference is regulatory. We were told by the legislature to clean up our act, and that's what the difference is. Now, the past couple of years, we've tried to work together legislatively for bills in this area so that we can resolve some of the problems. Okay? And unfortunately, the reason I'm here today is because of this issue, which should have never gotten this far. Because this agency had no business doing what it did to Dr. Siegfried, or not only him, but others.
Okay.
There are a lot of doctors who have spent $30,000 to $40,000 to defend themselves, who cannot afford it, but they've done it just to keep their license. That's the real crime.
Okay. We're going to introduce a bill to sunset chiropractic, to sunset the practice of chiropractic, unless you get your act together. It'll sunset in 2 years. It'll be over.
Mr. Chairman.
You all have to go somewhere else to practice. Idaho, Washington, California, Montana.
You have my permission.
Not Oregon, though.
You have my permission, Senator, because it won't affect me. I'm retired.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
You cannot have practice. You cannot have unity without justice. And what we witnessed that day was the total lack of justice. And I want to let you know I'm going to be filing complaints relative to this with the board later.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I would be very happy. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.
No. Senator George, I think this is something that needs to be worked on, so I'm not suggesting that we can't help, can't find a solution. Now, there's one other person signed up somewhere. Would you please come up briefly and... I'm afraid we're not going to go to any other bills today. I'm sorry for...
We have some people from the coast.
Okay, we will go to another bill.
Thank you. I'll be as brief as possible.
Which one are we... Excuse me just a minute. Which one are we looking at from the people from the coast?
You'll have to ask. What bill?
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll be brief. My name is Dr. Steve Koch. I'm a chiropractor. I've been in practice approximately 30 years. I'm currently practicing in Salem. I've been licensed in Oregon, New Mexico, California, and Georgia. I've seen a lot of boards. I've seen a lot of out-of-control boards. I got involved in this board. I'm a member of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, a new member. Some of you appointed me recently in the past few months to this board.
You're welcome.
I got involved with this board because I found it to be a highly functioning, very diverse board that was not like a lot of other boards I'd seen. My understanding is in the past 10 years, this board has turned over about two times. With all due respect to everyone who testified so far, I think we're hearing a lot of old issues that are really getting cleaned up. Both the organizations are lobbying together in discussions. There's a lot of dialogue going on. There's a lot of changes going on. The old guard is leaving, and there are new people in the field who don't want to keep the old vendettas going. And I think we're still cleaning up some of that. I agree with Senator George and his intentions for this bill. I think his intentions for what he's wanting to do are good, but I have to say with all respect that I think it's redundant. I think all these issues are covered in our existing rules and regulations and statutes, and the details that they're going into are covering areas that we already have covered. I believe that if there's an individual or individuals who are misusing or abusing their power, their privilege, and their responsibility on the board, they should be removed or dealt with. We should deal with the problem directly. In chiropractic, we look at getting to the cause of things, not just covering up symptoms. And I think that this bill does not address the cause and the root problems. It's just more words that aren't going to correct anything. I think we already have that covered there. What I'm asking is that we don't change sound policy and we don't tie the hands of the people that are entrusted with public safety. Like I said, I think there's old personal issues, and those times are over. The existing rules cover scope of investigations, conflicts of interest with the peer review, timeliness of handling complaints, and I don't believe this change is needed with all due respect. In addition, there was a lot of accusations about a certain case that I was the chair of the meeting of, and I have quite a different perspective. I'd just like to say that the committee that I headed up at that time stuck to the complaint, stuck to the specifics of the complaint, and followed it to the letter of the law as we were directed, with advice from the Attorney General's office that directed us how to handle legal issues. We don't go making up stuff on our own. The Attorney General's office advises us what to do. We have statutes that we refer back to make sure we can back up what we're doing and what we're asking for. And I think that about covers it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This has been an interesting, difficult meeting, but we'll
yes.
work on it. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on
8.
And open the public hearing on Senate Bill 769. Okay, got 15 minutes. Mel Cohn, would you like to come up, please?
Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to provide you some information about hepatitis C relevant to this bill. I'm going to be very brief because I know time is short, and I know there are others who want to testify. This is a huge public health problem. We estimate that about 2% of Oregonians are infected with hepatitis C. That's a huge percentage and a lot of people. And this is a disease that can kill. It's also a disease that can be transmitted to others, and there's a lot that we can be doing to try to prevent that. We also know that there are certain population groups that seem to be disproportionately affected by this. This is a virus that's often transmitted largely through intravenous drug use, so that's a group of people that need to be targeted particularly for the prevention efforts around this disease. We're already doing what I think we can do without substantial funding, and the only funding that we have right now for this is from the Centers for Disease Control. Some of those activities are outlined in the on the flip side of my testimony. So in summary, I think hepatitis C is a very important problem, one that affects the lives of a lot of Oregonians. We would like to be doing more, but unfortunately funding limits our ability to do that right now. Thank you.
So, Dr. Cohen, we heard some of the testimony. I heard some of the testimony in the Ways and Means Committee, and I heard that there is no state money going into Hep C. We had this discussion before, and I know that I don't know how you feel as part of the department under the governor's budget about introducing new items that are not in the governor's budget. Is this a concern?
Absolutely. I Chair Moore said that.
Put you on record as being
yes,
concerned about the governor's budget.
The department at this time is neutral on this bill because the funding is not included in the governor's budget. Okay, that's correct.
But aside from being neutral politically, you're favorable to the effort, at least theoretically, in doing something about hepatitis C in the state of Oregon, right?
Chair Morissette, absolutely.
Good. Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair, we are truly in need of, I know a lot of money's been put into HIV and screening that, but hepatitis C is far more prevalent than HIV. And if we could just spend even just a part of the money that we spend on HIV, put money into the Hep C program, which affects far more people than HIV.
Mr. Chair, I agree with Senator Morris Anderson, and I appreciate your approach, and I think I'm glad we've got a new sponsor, because when I was sponsoring it, it never went anywhere.
Senator Cruz, if you remember Phyllis Beck from Lane County, who came up a number of times, I also sponsored a bill, and we worked together on
We did.
It's been very frustrating. We've been working on this since probably 01, at least, maybe 99.
Yes.
And the other concern is what happens if in the prison system when people go in, are they tested? If so, are they treated? If so, what happens when they leave? Is there any follow-through? Probably not. And it is a huge problem. So we want to try to do something.
And Mr. Chair, when I was working for Clackamas County, we set up a screening program, a testing program in the jails, but we only had money to screen for hepatitis or for HIV. We did not screen. And here we had the population that we could truly reach out and help.
And you were already drawn.
Very frustrating.
You were already drawn the blood. You just had to put one more screen.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, I did notice on the sign-up sheet that you are neutral.
Officially.
Officially.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Dr. Peter Hauser and Lauren Sanded. Lauren and Shannon Kelly.
Sharon.
Okay. Could you all please come up?
Mr. Chair?
We are going to send this bill to Ways and Means for consideration, so we're going to do everything we can to move this, but we want to give you an opportunity to testify before this committee and then come back and testify before the Ways and Means Committee.
I have some handouts.
Okay, good. And I apologize for taking so long. We would have heard this bill first, only we did have someone waiting in Florida for us to contact them by phone. And
my wife used to live there.
Oh, okay. You want to talk about that for a while? We have 9 minutes left.
And then we got married. So.
Oh. Okay, I think it's almost time to adjourn. Who would like to lead off?
Senator Chair, respectfully, we're going to have Dr. Hauser talk, and then Sharon and I will just take a moment of your time afterwards in respect for all your time.
So thank you, Chair Morissette and members of the committee for giving me the opportunity to speak to you about a disease that I will be treating for the rest of my life. I don't think hepatitis C as an epidemic is really going away. I've made a handout for you and also provided you with a number of articles that that we have published. So I'll take you through these handouts. I'll just refer to particular pages. On page 2, as the previous person testified, and I guess I'm preaching to the choir, everyone agrees that we should be doing this. In regard to epidemiology, I think certainly hepatitis C is very common. It affects 1.8% of the general population. But what we shouldn't forget is that 60 to 90% of new IV drug users are infected within 6 to 12 months of using drugs. And 15 to 90% of specific subpopulations, some of which I'll talk to you today, these are people, and I feel that I'm speaking for those who don't often get to speak for themselves. These are people that are overlooked when it comes to getting health care. But 15 to 90% of specific subgroups have hepatitis C, and there are at least 30 to 35,000 new cases in the United States per year.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask?
Yes.
Just recently, I came across a number that we're 4% of the world's population, but we use 66% of the world's illicit drugs, and a good share of those are going to be some drugs in which the sharing of a needle would be involved.
Yes.
I mean, I think we're headed for an epidemic.
We are not headed for it. We're in it.
We're in it.
Okay. Absolutely.
And if any of you believe, and I've mentioned this, if any of you believe that there's a methamphetamine epidemic in Oregon and in the Northwest and in the United States, then you must believe there's a hepatitis C epidemic. There's just no way to see it otherwise. There just isn't. So thank you for bringing that up. 30% of the prison population has hepatitis C, and as I'll mention, in specific psychiatrically ill patients, anywhere from 15 to up to 30% have hepatitis C. So on page 3, what percentage of Hep C patients have comorbid psychiatric and substance use disorders? And we shouldn't forget that patients with hepatitis C often have these comorbid psychiatric and substance use disorders. That's how they got the illness in many cases, at least the substance use. And that's the vast majority. On page 4, this was a study that was published years ago. I think the take-home point is of the patients with hepatitis C in the VA, so these are veterans using VA facilities, and again, this was before the VA routinely screened patients for hepatitis C, 1.77% had hepatitis C. We now know that the the prevalence in the VA is three times that, 5.4%. That's of all patients. But you can see that of these that had Hep C, 78% had a past or present psychiatric use disorder, and cocaine use, interestingly, not IV drugs, but cocaine use was the most prevalent drug of abuse. We shouldn't forget, too, that even if you are an alcohol user, your risk of hepatitis C is higher than if you don't abuse alcohol. And we are not sure exactly why that is. It may be intermittent, IV drug use. It may be something about alcohol that lowers your immune system. So on page 5, again, these were some studies that we conducted in the Northwest. So this involved Oregon, Washington State, Idaho, and Alaska. This is the area of the country that's in our particular region of the VA that we serve, is in 20. Of 300,000 patients that we examined, you can see, we had controls, and then SUD stands for substance use disorder patients. SUD and BD stands for substance use disorder and bipolar patients. And then BD is if you only had a bipolar disorder and not hepatitis C. You can see that we were appropriately testing these patients. If you had a substance use disorder and bipolar disorder, 81% of these patients had been tested by the VA for hepatitis C. On page 6, you can see of these patients, 29% had hepatitis C. If you only had bipolar disorder and not a substance use disorder, 7% had hepatitis C. So bipolar disorder commonly has substance use as a comorbidity. So we're talking about a substantial proportion, as many as 1 in 5 to 1 in 4 having hepatitis C. This often, at least outside of the VA, goes undiagnosed. On page 7, again, this was another study looking at the seriously mentally ill, excluded bipolar patients, but included patients that had schizophrenia. Again, schizophrenics are often patients that have no access, or if they have any access, they have access to health care through mental health care clinics. Again, as you can see on page 8, very high rates of hepatitis C if you had a substance use disorder and schizophrenia.
What is SMI?
Seriously mentally ill.
Okay.
For our purposes, that included schizophrenics and patients with schizoaffective disorder. You can see 30% of patients that were tested that had a serious mental illness and substance use had hepatitis C. If you only had a serious mental illness, 10% of those patients that were tested had hepatitis C. Page 9, again, just goes over how we develop better models of care for patients with hepatitis C. And I think it's very important to integrate mental health care into existing hepatology clinics and screen hepatitis C patients for psychiatric and substance use disorder. Conversely, I think we should be offering people education about hep C, not only those people that have hepatitis C, but also those people that have risk factors for hepatitis C. If they're not yet infected and they find out about what hepatitis C is all about, we may be able to prevent them from getting that illness. Page 10, again, just goes over some of our data. We screened patients with hepatitis C that were coming to our hep C clinic, and 78% of them had screened positive for depression. 53% of them, we are a VA facility, had PTSD. 56% of them had a substance use disorder. But 30% of them were still actively drinking at the time that they came to the hep C clinic. That's one of the worst things you can do if you have hepatitis C, because alcohol accelerates the damage done by hepatitis C. And that's shown on the next page, page 11, that you increase your risk of cirrhosis, liver damage, by drinking if you have hepatitis C. It may be a 100-fold increase over those patients that don't have hepatitis C and don't drink, but at least 10-fold over those people that have hepatitis C and don't drink. So another intervention, once Oregon has the money, right, besides paying for treatment, which I think will pay for itself, is offering these patients with hepatitis C some sort of treatment for their substance use, at least their alcohol use disorders. Page 12 goes over the specific issue in this bill, patient education. We have an education group. There is a DVD that I passed around that we developed in the Portland VA with Seattle. This goes over the slide set that we use to educate patients about hepatitis C. It is available in the public domain. It's free. It doesn't cost a dime to download it, aside from the computer time and the frustration of having to deal with computers, which I still don't particularly care for. It's great when it works, but when it doesn't, I tell you, I'm losing hair by the minute. So on page 13, I'm just going over some of the data that suggests how valuable patient education can be. We basically gave people a test before they took our patient education slideshow. We did it in a group, so you can do 10, 15 people at a time, 45-minute patient education, and then we tested them again to see how much they remembered. And this slide on page 13 basically goes over that they almost doubled their knowledge about hepatitis C after a 45-minute intervention. And they more than doubled their information, if you look all the way on the right side of the slide, about treatment of hepatitis C. How do you treat it? They more than doubled their knowledge about that. And we have other data to suggest they actually remembered this, you know, weeks later or months later, although there was some decrease in their knowledge. I've listed on page 14 the the website where this information can be downloaded. We have various, in the DVD that you have, various patient education and provider education materials, not only a slide set, but how to develop a support group for patients with hepatitis C, et cetera, et cetera. And again, we in Portland have really focused on this and are seen as a national resource for the VA. So to summarize, I think, again, as I mentioned, if you believe there's a methamphetamine epidemic in Oregon, then you must also believe there's a hepatitis C epidemic. I think, although it's not certainly the purview of this bill, it would be important to mandate or at least strongly encourage hepatitis C screening and education for people with psychiatric and substance use disorders, because that's where the money is. Most of our patients with hepatitis C are already living in mental health care and substance abuse treatment clinics and facilities. It makes sense. It's also the right thing to do. Screening patients with hep C for psychiatric and substance use disorder, I think, is essential because they often have this comorbidity, and treatment shouldn't just be about the liver disease, but how you got there in the first place. And finally, I think the future of hep C treatment is in developing these models of care that incorporate assessment, education, and management of psychiatric illness and substance abuse and hepatitis C. Thanks, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Why do you think we've been so slow to act on hepatitis C in the state of Oregon?
My own personal opinion is generally, and not specifically to the state of Oregon, generally, we don't want to know the extent of the problem. I think we are underestimating the extent of the problem. Many of the patients that have hepatitis C never get tested, so we really don't know the extent of the problem, and I think it's only going to get worse. I think we focused on issues that get people to the point of having hepatitis C, the substance abuse, right, to some degree, than actually looking at how we can comprehensively provide health care that's inclusive rather than focusing just on substance abuse if those patients get there at all. I think, as well, there's an attitude, at least among some people, that if you have hepatitis C, you did it to yourself. And I think we have to get away from that attitude that substance abuse is an illness that just can't be willed away. And a consequence of substance abuse is hepatitis C. So those are just some thoughts.
Are we supposed to be out of here by 5? We have to be in another hearing room by 5.
All right.
Did you want to briefly?
We're going to pass.
Thank you for your time. I just handed out two pieces of information. One is the testimony that I did provide to Ways and Means, and it was recommendations from the report that the Governor's Council, I'm sorry, I'm Sharon Kelly, I'm a member of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, with Senator Mona Sanderson as well. And in the report, we made some recommendations for how we should address hepatitis C, and it was a statewide program which totaled about $1 million, and so testified accordingly. I wanted to make sure that you understood what we said to them and that we said the very same thing to you so that it's on the record. The second report is a document that I wrote in the year 2000 about the death of my son. It was published in the Oregonian, and I really still can't talk about it. It was just much easier to write about it. He died of hepatitis C and B, and in a time when they were not giving treatment to people who had addictions because they felt for a number of reasons that it wasn't worthwhile, and they hadn't thought about giving hepatitis B inoculations to people who had hepatitis C. If either one of those things had been done, he'd still be alive. There's a lot of things that we could still be doing right now to save people's lives, and we're still not doing it, and I agree with what the doctor said, but I would also add that it's similar to AIDS. In the 1980s, we thought that AIDS belonged to those other people. And to a great degree, some people didn't have a lot of regard for those other people. The other people in hepatitis C are IV drug users and the mentally ill. So I think, to a large part, it's also discrimination. I mean, when you think about it, we're tracking the same thinking and the same progress that we did with AIDS.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Yes.
And if you read, Sharon, this is just beautiful. It's
It's Mark, her son, and if you read it, it's extremely moving. Would like the committee members to do that. Thank you.
Senator Morissette and chairs, thank you for hearing the bill today and for, I won't take up any time with your testimony, have my written testimony. I don't think there's anything else I can say other than no one is immune to hepatitis C. It's time we do something about it, and I really appreciate you folks taking a step forward and being positive, taking positive action on hepatitis C. I know I have some champions up here at the front, and we greatly appreciate all of you. So please take action. It's time for Oregon to take action.
Okay, and we hope that you will join us in the Ways and Means Subcommittee when it gets there, because we have to fight for the money.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 769 and open a work session on Senate Bill 769.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 769 to the Committee on Ways and Means with an enthusiastic, loud, and abrasive, if necessary, do-pass recommendation.
Good. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 769 to the Subcommittee on Ways and Means with a do-pass recommendation. Concerns, questions, comments? Well,
can we get his language in there?
Yes, we can. But okay, so move. Thank you. Thank you very much for being here. And we will carry over Senate Bill 2242, House Bill 2242, and Senate Bill 754 until Wednesday, our next hearing. We'll carry those two bills over. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.